Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, September 9th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Franciscan Heights Senior Community, located off exit 7, I-90 Rensselaer, offering maintenance-free, professionally managed community for seniors. DePaulHousing.com for photos and information. Joining us this afternoon is Dr. David Hart. Dr. Hart is a board-certified neurologist at the Stratton VA Medical Center in Albany. He is here to answer your questions about Alzheimer's and a range of other neurological issues. Call early. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. 800-348-2551 or email voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. David Hart and your calls coming up right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Medical Monday, and joining us once again is Dr. David Hart. Dr. Hart is a board-certified neurologist at the Stratton VA Medical Center in Albany, where he sees general neurology and memory patients with a focus on Alzheimer's and other dementias. He's practiced in Albany since the early 90s, both in private practice and in academic settings. Over the last 25 years, he's seen overseen numerous clinical trials in Alzheimer's disease, including studies of several recently FDA-approved and pending treatments which slow the progression of Alzheimer's. If you have a question, give us a shout, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or feel free to email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. David Hart, how are you? Welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I'm doing great.
So big news in July, yeah?
Yeah, another disease-modifying agent for Alzheimer's disease was approved.
And what's this one about, and why is it different than some of the others?
It has the same basic mechanism of action as the other disease-modifying agent, which was lecanemab. This is donanemab, or Kisunla is the brand name of it. And it's a monoclonal antibody, so it's an engineered antibody that binds amyloid protein in the brain and helps remove it. We've known for 100 years almost that one of the hallmarks of Alzheimer's was a buildup of this normal protein, amyloid protein, in the brain substance, like little golf balls of protein in between the nerve cells. And people still argue about how that affects the brain, but we know that that is strongly associated with Alzheimer's disease. And now there are two agents that have shown not just a statistical benefit, but a clinical benefit in slowing progression.
Now, to be clear, you said that it will remove some of these amyloid plaques, right?
Correct.
Where do they go?
Well, so the amyloid plaque itself is a ball of protein, and these antibodies bind the protein, and they get it out of the brain, and that reduces the amount of amyloid there.
But how do they get them out of the brain? There's the blood-brain barrier, right?
Exactly.
How does it get those out?
Well, because there's something called the glymphatic system. In the body as a whole, there are arteries and veins and lymphatic vessels. People probably heard of lymph nodes. You know, with somebody who has breast cancer, they check the lymph nodes looking for signs of spread. That's true with many other cancers as well. And this is a set of plumbing, basically, that helps drain the extracellular fluid, the fluid that bathes the cells, after that fluid has left the arteries and veins. There's an equivalent system to that in the brain called the glymphatic system. And the immune system, there are immune cells in the brain which help to fight off infection, help to take care of degenerated brain cells and get them out of the way. And so these immune cells can grab the amyloid protein once the antibody has put, in effect, a handle onto it. They grab the amyloid, get it out of the circulating in the extracellular fluid, and the immune cells take that. They're able to then clear that. These are microglial cells. They take that antibody, they break it down and destroy it intracellularly.
Now, to be clear, in your very careful description of what this drug does, you did not say it allows for a regression of the disease. So once you have Alzheimer's, it's not necessarily going to get better if you remove these plaques. Why is that?
Well, First off, you're right. It's not going to get better from treatment with these two medications. It's not going to stop from treatment with these two medications. It's going to progress more slowly. And that's a big thing, because if you have more time when you're in a mildly impaired state, when it's just a little bit of memory difficulty, as opposed to more time where you're not able to dress yourself or you're not able to remember where the bathroom is, that's a big quality of life difference.
I guess where I'm going with this is you have some medications that will reduce some of those plaques. But are the plaques merely a symptom of this mysterious disease or Alzheimer's affliction, whatever you want to call it, or are they the reason it happens?
There continues to be an argument about that. The people who say that they're just an epiphenomenon, they're just a byproduct of the disease process, point to many of the medication failures over the last quarter century. But there are three situations in which people have a single gene mutation that causes Alzheimer's. If you have that gene, you are going to develop Alzheimer's, and you're probably going to develop it very young, in your 40s, maybe in your 30s, certainly by your 50s. All three of those gene mutations result in an overproduction of amyloid protein. There's a fourth genetic syndrome where people have an extra copy of the amyloid precursor protein gene, and they produce too much of it, and they develop early onset Alzheimer's as well. That's Down syndrome. They have three copies of chromosome 21, which is where the amyloid precursor protein gene lives. And as a result, they produce more amyloid. And so they almost universally develop Alzheimer's disease and do so at quite young ages often.
Dr. David Hart is our guest today on this edition of Medical Monday. Dr. Hart is a board-certified neurologist at the Stratton VA Medical Center in Albany. Before we get to the emails, we have plenty of those, and calls as well. When we were talking before the show, you were discussing a situation in the waiting room or whatever where you are, where you were analyzing someone's gait. And I thought that was so interesting. What can you as a neurologist learn just by watching how someone walks?
You can learn a lot. Obviously, walking is a bihemispheric process. So you know that the left side of the brain controls the right side of the body. Controls the left side of the body.
Okay.
Well, most people have heard that somewhere along the line. But right. To walk, it's not just hopping on one foot. It's both legs moving, both arms moving, maintaining your center of gravity above your base of support. So both hemispheres have to communicate. They have to time things properly. There's a sequence of events that has to happen. So there's a lot of wiring and processing that's necessary to walk properly. And so looking at how somebody walks is a big part of the neurologic exam. You can see signs of Parkinson's disease. You can see signs of a peripheral nerve problem or a nerve root problem, like from a disc. You can see signs of stroke or of cerebral palsy. There's a lot you can learn just by walking the patient in from the exam room.
All right, one email here, and then we'll take a break. Dr. David Hart is our guest from the Stratton VA Medical Center in Albany. This is from Lori in Enfield, Connecticut. Lori writes, "My boyfriend who lives in Florida has early dementia. Every week I help him over the phone, no FaceTime, fill up his weekly pill keeper. Currently he's able to do this with my help, but what can we do when he can't complete this?"
Well, there are a couple of things. There are a lot of pharmacies that will create a pill pack for you. You get all the monthly prescriptions in, and then they make little blister packs that have the morning pills or the evening pills or the pills for Wednesday separated out. There are also automatic pill boxes. They look kind of like a double-sided Frisbee, and just there's a kind of a pie-shaped opening on them. You can program it in so that it opens up at the appropriate time. It has an alarm on it that doesn't turn off unless you turn the thing over to dump the pills out of it. It doesn't guarantee that they make it from your hand into your mouth, but for a lot of people, that can be a lot of help as well.
All right,
those are pretty cheap now, too.
One more email here, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll hit the phones. Dr. David Hart is our guest. 800-348-2551 is the number. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Nancy writes, "Can you talk about the tau protein and its impact on developing Alzheimer's? Is there a test to find out if one is developing a buildup of tau? If someone doesn't have tau protein buildup in their late 60s, how likely is it they'll develop it later on?" Before you answer that, tell us what tau protein is.
Sure. So there are two proteins that are linked to Alzheimer's. There's amyloid that we've been talking about, and then there's tau. Tau's role is much better defined than amyloid. Tau helps to link the cytoskeleton, the structure of the nerve cell, to the cell membrane. And it allows the nerve cell to do the things that it needs to do. It allows it to move metabolic products down the filament of the nerve, the axon of the nerve. And in Alzheimer's disease, pieces of tau protein become overly sticky, and instead of binding the cytoskeleton to the membrane, they stick together and they form what are called neurofibrillary tangles. Mm. And these are basically like bundles of twist ties inside the nerve cell that gum up the works. So that's what tau is. There is imaging for tau. There are a couple of radio tracers. So you can look for tau the same way that you look for amyloid in the brain. You can measure tau in the spinal fluid. And there are some blood tests that are in development for tau that I don't think are quite ready for prime time, but that are getting pretty close. The exciting thing about tau is that it accumulates much closer in time to when people develop symptoms. Also, if you do a tau scan, where it builds up first is a much better indicator of the symptoms people have. Usually it's the memory system, which is kind of in the inner aspect of the temporal lobe of the brain. But for people who have a primary language disorder, it's in the language areas. And there's some folks who have what's called posterior cortical atrophy, where they develop a lot of problems with visuospatial processing. They can't get their clothes on right. They can't figure out how far away things are. They get lost in the house or in the neighborhood. They can't drive well. The tau builds up in the visual processing cortex in that. So there is some testing that, at least on an investigational level, is available now. Currently, I'm not sure that it adds much beyond amyloid testing. Tau is also involved in a number of other disorders, and there are different kinds of tau. The one that's present in Alzheimer's is hyperphosphorylated tau, and that seems to be specific for that. But non-phosphorylated tau, total tau levels, are just a sign of neuronal injury. And you can see that in frontotemporal dementia. You can see that in cell death from encephalitis or brain infections or a lot of degenerative processes.
We're joined by Dr. David Hart. He's our guest today. We talk about neurology and specifically dementia, Alzheimer's, et cetera. Number is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll hit the phones in a moment. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. It's Medical Monday. Dr. David Hart is our guest. Dr. Hart is a neurologist at the Stratton VA Medical Center in Albany. Before we get to the phones, let me loop back to the news you had about this new drug that has been approved back in July, donanemab. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. I mentioned the blood-brain barrier, mm-hmm. and many times on this show we talk about that sort of thing, and I just wonder, how do you get the drug into the brain? It's sort of a moat, if you will, or something that keeps stuff out. How do you get that drug in there? I always heard that it was difficult to get stuff in.
Well, it's an excellent question. And I guess part of the answer is we do it by brute force. Only about 1% of the donanemab or the lecanemab that is administered cross the blood-brain barrier. And there's no bodily system that's perfect. So like with anything else, there are some areas where the blood-brain barrier is not as intact as it could be or as it was when you and I were younger. And as you get older, the integrity of the blood-brain barrier is not quite as good as it was. But right now, it's by brute force. Well, it's because you give 100 times the dose that's actually going to get into the brain. Now, there are some
orally or by shot?
Infusions, intravenous infusions, okay. Given by an IV.
Gotcha.
But there was a cool study a year or two ago looking at transcranial ultrasound. They used ultrasound, focusing it on a part of the brain commonly affected in Alzheimer's. And it's known that if you do that a certain way, you open up the blood-brain barrier temporarily. So they did this to one half of the brain. They shortly afterwards treated with an amyloid antibody, and they did this for a group of patients for a period of time, and then they did brain amyloid imaging, and they found that the hemisphere that was treated had a much lower burden of amyloid than the hemisphere that was not treated.
Interesting. I assume there may be some risks when you lower those defenses on one side of the brain.
Yeah, if you're doing it just for a brief period of time, then probably the risks are not as high. But it's cumbersome too. It's a great proof of concept, but it's maybe not a practical way to treat, you know, the millions of folks that are going to need to be treated. There are other folks who are developing active transport proteins. These are proteins that can bind to the amyloid and that have, they're not just looking for a leaky spot to get through. They have a molecular pass across the blood-brain barrier. And so the first of those is, I think, maybe in phase two clinical trials at this point. Hmm. But that's a really very promising avenue.
We're joined by Dr. David Hart today. The number is 800-348-2551. We'll get back to the emails in a bit, but let's go to the phones. We'll start in Otis, Massachusetts. Kristen, you're up.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. I had a question. So my mom has Alzheimer's, and she's had it for, I don't know, maybe about 8 years now. She's pretty late stage. She's having difficulty with her vision. Her eyes have changed color. Her pupils are pinpricks. We've been to several doctors, and nobody's been able to really give us any clear answer. I know as a neurological disorder, it makes sense that her vision would change. You know, she has trouble with depth perception. But the fact that her eye color has changed and her pupils are so small, it just seems so weird. The only medication she's really on for Alzheimer's is donepezil. She's not on any comfort meds or anything for sundowning. So I was just curious if you had any advice about what treatments or what tests we could request.
First, I would say that a change in the eye color is pretty unusual, at least to me as a neurologist. And I think the best thing to do would be to have her, you know, have a good thorough ophthalmologic evaluation. And if a general eye doctor doesn't have the answer, then maybe thinking about seeing a neuro-ophthalmologist. And that's somebody who specializes in neurologic disorders and how they affect the eye. It's common as people get older for the pupils to constrict somewhat and become poorly reactive just because the wiring isn't working quite the way that it used to. But that mm-hmm. would not affect eye color. Donepezil that your mom is taking has been on the market for at least 25 years now, and I've had I don't know how many thousand patients on it myself, and I've never seen that as a side effect. I don't think that has anything to do with it. So I think just getting a good eye evaluation by an ophthalmologist and maybe a neuro-ophthalmologist is probably the way to go.
Okay, just keep plugging away. And I was actually hoping that maybe you could spell that medication that you were talking about earlier in the show. I was trying to write it down, but I'm not sure I spelled it right.
Now sure. comes the test.
All right, so donanemab is D-O-N-A-N-E-M-A-B.
Thank you.
All of the monoclonal antibody medicines end in MAB. It's abbreviation for monoclonal antibody. Mm. So this is donanemab. The other one that is FDA approved and shown effective is lecanemab.
Lecanemab. Okay.
Lecanemab. L with as
oh,
in.
Oh, lec.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay, Kristen. Thanks okay. a lot. Appreciate the call very much. 800-348-2551 is our number. Let's see. Let's go to Bennington. Ramona, you're on. Hello.
Hello. I had a pinched nerve, a sciatic pinched nerve in June, and then I got it again, a recurring one in the middle of August. And I'm calling to ask the questions that I didn't address when I had it in June, which is, what's the first thing that I do when I notice it? Do I adjust my posture? Do I decrease the inflammation with ice? Do I walk? How much rest do I need? What do I need to do to, you know, help myself?
Well, I think a lot of times when people have sciatic distribution pain, pain that's running down from the buttock down the back of the thigh, down towards the calf and sometimes into the foot. A lot of times that is musculoligamentous, that some of the muscles of the buttocks and of the pelvis that are pressing on the nerve and inflaming it a little bit. So gentle range of motion stretching can be good. Walking some is definitely good, much better than just sitting around, but it's also not something you want to over-exercise. And you know, I think people argue about the relative benefits of heat versus ice. Some people say you should use ice, but only acutely. Then it should be heat after that. And people argue about it. I think you should do whichever one feels the best for you. But I think trying to alter how you're walking is a good way to end up with problems elsewhere. So I would try not to do that.
Okay. And so posture also, you adjust your posture to stand up in a stretchy way so that helps also?
Well, you want to try to stand with good posture, keep your back erect, try not to slouch. It puts a lot more stress on the axial musculature, the muscles along the spine that hold you upright. So you want to try and have good posture, you know, good support for your back when you're sitting, and frequent position changes and gentle stretching.
All right, Ramona, thanks for the call. Must be refreshing to get a pinched nerve question once in a while, yeah?
You know, it's nice doing general neurology.
All right, let's go to Albany. And Jackie, you're on.
Hi, I have a question. I've heard the expression lately say Alzheimer's is the new diabetes type 3. And I'm just curious to understand that condition, if it is in fact a new condition, to understand it better. And what things, is it genetically linked, or can one decrease the likelihood of such a condition with, nutrition and lifestyle?
Well, I think something that, an axiom that I was taught maybe my first week of medical school and is still true is that if you know diabetes, you know all of medicine, because diabetes can affect any part of the body and it can interact with just about any medical condition. If you have diabetes, you have a much higher risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. And I'm not sure that anybody knows exactly how that works. We know that hyperglycemia, a high blood glucose level, is kind of pro-inflammatory. We know that high blood sugar levels are not good for the brain. On the other hand, the brain is the only organ that does not store energy. And so it needs a constant supply of nutrition, usually glucose, but also ketone bodies. So there is a link there. I'm not sure that any of the basic scientists have it in much more detail than that, but diabetes is definitely a strong risk factor. And so the things that are good for your blood sugar, whole grains and avoiding concentrated sweets and refined sugars and things like that are also good for your brain health. And, they're good for your vasculature, and anything that's good for your heart and your arteries is good for the brain as well. So it's all interconnected there.
Jackie, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. 800-348-2551 is our number. 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. David Hart is our guest. Did you just say the brain is the only organ in the body that does not store energy?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. Why? What's no mitochondria? What's going on?
No, the mitochondria burn energy. They don't store it.
So
the brain has no, the fat that's in the brain is insulation. It's not an energy substrate. The brain doesn't store glycogen like the muscles do and like the liver does. So it's, if there's not, if your blood sugar drops down for a half an hour, your muscles are probably not going to notice. But if your blood sugar drops down for a half an hour, your brain notices that 25 minutes before you got to the half an hour.
That is amazing. I've never heard that before. Dr. David Hart is our guest today. And let's see, I just closed the email box like a fool. Oh, here we go. This one is from Peter. Subject heading, dementia and Alzheimer's. Research seems to keep changing, so I want a definitive answer. Definitive answer. Are normal dementia and Alzheimer's disease completely separate entities, or are they overlapping?
Well, they're overlapping. Dementia is the category, and Alzheimer's is a specific subtype of that category. So all Alzheimer's is dementia. Dementia is a decline in cognitive function from your maximum achieved baseline. So whatever your normal was once you achieved adulthood, whatever, however smart you got to be, a drop-off from that that's not due to some easily reversible process is considered dementia. about two-thirds, about 65% of dementia is Alzheimer's disease. Maybe 15 to 20% is vascular dementia caused by either a few large strokes or by a series of many small strokes, sometimes without any clinical symptoms. Maybe 15 to 20% of dementia is related to dementia with Lewy bodies, which is somewhat related to Parkinson's. And then the remainder is HIV dementia, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, dementia and other illnesses, HIV, Parkinson's dementia, which is different from dementia with Lewy bodies. So it's kind of like people say to me, is it Alzheimer's or is it a dementia? It's kind of like asking, is it blue or is it a color? Dementia is the category, and Alzheimer's is the specific and most common subtype.
Dr. David Hart is our guest today from the Stratton VA Medical Center in Albany. An email from Mike. I am slightly off balance most of the time. I sometimes start to fall, but catch myself. I'm 75, otherwise fine. Thank you. Well, there's no question there, but go ahead.
Well, so it sounds like you need to talk to somebody and see what's going on. Your problems with your balance can come from the inner ear. You have motion sensors in the inner ear. Usually, if that's where the issue is, that gives you kind of a spinny feeling or a constantly moving feeling. Vertigo is that sensation of movement. It can come from the cerebellum, which is a major coordination center in the brain. It can come from a problem in sensation. You don't think about it, but you have sensors in the muscles that can tell you how stretched or tightened those muscles are. You have sensors within the joints that can tell you how straightened or how bent they are. And all these systems interplay to give you your sense of equilibrium. So if there's something that's off, somebody needs to take a look at it and check it out. And you, as a 75-year-old guy who wants to maintain your health, you've got to be careful in getting around. You have to be careful with position changes. It's a really good idea when you stand up from a chair or get out of bed to stand there for a moment or two before you get headed off across the room so that if you're not fully balanced, you can sit back down in the chair rather than doing a face plant and meeting the many wonderful trauma surgeons that we have in the area. I'd rather they find their own patients than have access to you.
Dr. David Hart is our guest, 800-348-2551. The brain is an incredible thing. They talk about AI and how much it can do, but you just said, oh, yeah, you have sensors in your muscles that'll say whether they're stretched or straight or moving around. Do we even know all the things the brain can do?
Probably not. It's an extraordinary organ, and the nervous system as a whole is, there's no system in the body that has anywhere near the elegance of the nervous system. The immune system is a relative second, but, the heart's really important. It's just a pump.
Right.
The lungs are really important. They're just a gas exchange membrane. But, the brain not only guides you across the room, not only tells you that you're thirsty and you want that beer while you're watching the latest Giants debacle.
Oh, God.
But it,
thank you for bringing that up.
Well, you didn't sit there from the stadium to watch it, which unfortunately some of us did.
Well, let me tell you something. Oh, you went?
Yeah.
That game made my brain hurt. I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go one phone call. We'll take a break, and then we'll go back to Dr. David Hart. I had no idea that you were a fellow sufferer, Giants fan. All right, let's go to Jim in Matamoros. Jim.
As we get older, tend not to drink as much. Would proper hydration have anything on slowing Alzheimer's?
Well, I don't think it's going to affect the course of Alzheimer's at all. But if you're not properly hydrated, then that stresses your kidneys and it stresses your cardiovascular system and it stresses your body. We know that the changes, for example, in Alzheimer's begin 20 years or more before people develop clinical symptoms. And through most of that time, your brain is compensating for the damage that's being done so that you don't have to notice it. Anything that stresses you, whether that's being relatively dehydrated or having a fever or being up all night worrying about something, takes away from the brain's ability to compensate. So it's not something that's going to – being hydrated isn't going to cure or prevent Alzheimer's, but it's going to help minimize its effects on you.
All right, Jim, thanks a lot. We'll take a break here. 800-348-2551 is our number. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. David Hart joins us. We'll be back. Hey, reminder, tomorrow night, 7 to 9 p.m., we will present a pre-presidential debate special roundtable panel with a wide range of experts. They'll talk about the importance of the debate, and you get a chance to support WAMC's Lockbox. It'll get you primed for the presidential debate at 9 p.m. It'll include insights from the panel, your questions, the opportunity to support us. All that money goes to the October Fund Drive, so be generous, won't you? It's tomorrow night at 7, WAMC's pre-presidential debate special roundtable panel, only on WAMC, and you can learn more at WAMC.org. And right now, we are talking neurology and dementia with Dr. David Hart of the Stratton VA Medical Center in Albany. Let's grab a couple of emails here, and then we'll go back to the phones. This one's from Fran. Fran says, I have eczema, which seems to feel more itchy at night when I'm trying to sleep. I've been using Benadryl, and it does help. I have read recently that people over 65 shouldn't use it, as it is frequent as its frequent use can lead to dementia or Alzheimer's. Is that accurate? I'm female and 77. And that's from Fran.
Yeah, Fran, I would say there's a couple of levels to your question that I want to answer. First is that definitely there's a link between the anticholinergics like Benadryl or diphenhydramine and an increased risk of dementia. One of the ways that Alzheimer's affects the brain is that it impairs the cholinergic system. And so the medicines like Aricept that have been around since the mid-90s that we use to help improve memory in Alzheimer's, they increase the amount of acetylcholine that's available to the brain. A medicine like Benadryl blocks acetylcholine, and so it's good for the itch, but it's bad for brain functioning.
Hmm.
You can think about trying lotions or things like that that help to moisten the skin, and that may be of some benefit. But the bottom line question is your quality of life. You don't want a dementia, but if you spend your whole life writhing all night long in bed because you're so itchy and you're terribly miserable, that's not much of a benefit either. If nothing else works for you, then use the Benadryl. It's, you know, the world's an imperfect place, and you just got to make the compromises that get you through.
Our guest today is Dr. David Hart. The number is 800-348-2551. This email from Stephanie. I have heard that people with type 2 diabetes are more likely to develop dementia. Well, we talked about that. I've also heard, says Stephanie, metformin mitigates the chances of developing dementia. Can you comment on these statements and whether there is any research focused on people with type 2 diabetes taking metformin?
Yeah, metformin is an interesting medication. It's a medicine that's used to treat insulin resistance. It's a medicine that's been used to treat what's called prediabetes, when people have just a little bit of blood glucose elevation. And there is evidence that it has some protective effect against Alzheimer's disease. I don't think anybody really understands the mechanism for that, but I haven't been following the basic science of it, so maybe somebody does and I've just missed it. But it's yet another link between, you know, general body health and how the brain is working and what puts the brain at risk.
I want to go back to Fran's email for a moment. She mentioned that she was 77. It's a pretty good run if you have all your marbles at 77. Now, if you hit that plateau or if you hit 80, are you at any less risk of getting it, aside from obviously you don't have more than 20 or 30 years to live? But if you made it that far, are you going to get dementia?
The risk of dementia probably does continue to increase through your age as you continue to get older. Maybe in the very old, the risk of Alzheimer's may drop off some, but the numbers are so small that it's hard to have a lot of confidence in them.
Yeah.
There's not, because you have some people, the super healthy elderly that don't go to doctors very much. They don't get involved in studies to a great extent. And
okay.
But as you get older, yeah, unfortunately, your risk continues to grow. That's why we keep trying to do the basic science research and figure out what we can do in addition to the meds we've been talking about today.
I'm not a doctor, but I'm pretty sure something will get you anyway at some point. All right, this is from Linda, and then we'll go back to the phones. Linda writes, someone I love was diagnosed with primary progressive aphasia. The disease is progressing, and communication is difficult for him. Now he has fainted or passed out 3 times in the past month. He's seen a neurologist. Now they say he should see a cardiologist. How does a heart doctor enter into this equation that I thought was a brain problem, and what could be causing him to pass out? And that's from Linda.
Well, so primary progressive aphasia. Aphasia is a language disturbance, and primary progressive aphasia is a subtype of dementia. There are three different varieties of it. I don't think we need to get bogged down in that, but it's a degenerative process from one of two main pathologic problems. Alzheimer's can cause a primary progressive aphasia, as can FTD. It does not typically cause people to faint. So if your friend is fainting, then the question is his heart slowing down too much? If he's using a medicine like Aricept or galantamine or rivastigmine, those are medicines that can slow the heart rate down and can increase the risk of fainting. Does he have a heart rhythm disturbance where the heart's beating too quickly? Does he have a problem with blood pressure regulation? A cardiologist can help to answer some of those questions. Depending on what he looks like when it happens, another possibility if he has a brain degenerative disorder is he could be having seizures. And so if there's not a heart rhythm or a hemodynamic explanation, then that has to be looked at.
Dr. David Hart is our guest today on this edition of Medical Monday. Dr. Hart is a board-certified neurologist at the Stratton VA Medical Center in Albany. And let's go back to the phones. Let's see who's been... Oh, all right. John in Clifton Park has been waiting longest. You're on, John. Go.
Hi. Yes, a couple years ago I heard about research where there's a frequency of light and sound, and when it's played, your brain starts cleaning itself. Do you know anything about this? And what is that frequency so I can start listening to it?
Well, in terms of light, there is some basic science data that phototherapy can be of some benefit. I'm not sure that it's ever moved from, you know, the very basic science investigations into it to having any proof of clinical benefit. But there are folks, I know there's a group in Boston that are looking into that, and there are folks that are happy to sell you.
Yeah, I think that's where it was.
Yeah, there are people who are happy to sell you light probes that you can put into the nose or into the ears. And, you know, I definitely wouldn't spend the money on anything like that until there's some strong evidence of benefit. We were talking earlier about the transcranial ultrasound, which is a frequency of sound that's used to disrupt the blood-brain barrier and maybe improve amyloid clearance. So that's something that a specific tool is used. Transcranial ultrasound has some potential risks to it. You can injure the brain and cause stroke-like effects from it. So that's something that has to be done carefully and by an expert. Again, not something where you want to look for a device on eBay and start treating yourself.
Yeah, I was under the impression that, like, just listening to the sound, like you could listen through headphones, but no.
No, I don't think that's it.
Okay. Well, thanks, John. Appreciate the call. Dr. David Hart is our guest to Wilton, and it's Richard's turn. Richard, go.
Hello. I'm sorry if this is, I tune in late, so this may have been covered. My wife is 81 years old. She's suffering from something. She cannot, has extreme difficulty walking, standing, and she spontaneously falls down, and she will fall down like a tree cut in the forest. She doesn't crumple. She falls literally 90 degrees. She's been in the hospital several times. But anyways, they've ruled out IBM, that's inclusive body myositis. She's had every blood test. She's had MRIs of her legs, her spine, and we have run out of things to do. We ruled out Parkinson's. She's had a DAT scan. She's had an EEG last week. That's a negative. And we're at a loss to find out what the heck is wrong with her.
Sometimes it's a really challenging problem to deal with, but what you're describing is, I would think, a brain problem. I'm not surprised that there's no evidence of a muscle problem or a spine disorder. When people have weakness, if they have a bad joint or if they have a myopathy, a muscle destructive process or something like that, they tend to crumple right down. Their legs give out and they fall right down on top of themselves. But it sounds like you're describing more of a balance issue, and that can come from a lot of different things. And working with a neurologist to try and get that answer is the best route to go. It sounds like you've already started with that if you had a DAT scan and an EEG. And sometimes it can be really tough to figure out what the answer is.
Here's something that's different. She went to the dentist last week for an introduction. So she had complete x-rays done of every tooth in her body. And they looked at the infections that are in there right now, that the doctor, Dennis, pointed out to us. And to make a long story short, can that affect your system? Because they explain in the dentist office, of course, if you have an abscess tooth or something, that goes into your bloodstream. The bloodstream is in contact with the central nervous system, and there is an outside chance, they said, of yes, the tooth could be causing her problem.
Well, I don't think it's likely that it's passing infection to the brain through the bloodstream. She would have to be pretty terribly sick for that to be likely to occur. But it's certainly possible that whatever is going on in the brain is being made worse by her having dental abscesses.
All right, Richard, thanks for the call. You know, urinary tract infections, on the other hand, old fella that I knew, he had dementia, and it was sort of plateaued, and eventually he went basically just over the cliff. Unfortunately, that happens a lot in this. But there was a time when he was sort of plateaued, and he went absolutely, what we said, okay, this is the end. He's gone nuts. It was a urinary tract infection. Mm-hmm. Why is that different than a tooth infection?
It's not. It's just that it's a process that causes inflammation in the body, and that inflammation in the body affects the brain. And it takes away from the brain's ability to compensate for the pathology that's there. The brain is trying hard to cover up the deficits, let you function at as high a level as possible. But, you know, you can think of the brain as kind of being a juggler. And some people can juggle one or two balls, and some people can juggle seven. But everybody's got a limit. You know, you throw one ball too many in there, that urinary tract infection, then that takes away the brain's ability to compensate. You drop all the balls.
Interesting. So is this what a baseline is? When you set a baseline for a patient, what exactly are you doing?
Well, you're trying to figure out what somebody's best level of function is.
How do you do it, I mean?
Well, it depends what you're looking at. If you're looking at coordination or if you're looking at cognitive function, there's a kind of a scale called the Montreal Cognitive Assessment, a similar one called the St. Louis University Mental Status Exam. And these are, you know, brief office screening tools that are good for kind of benchmarking what somebody's cognitive level of function is. They're appropriate not for screening the general population, I would say, but they're appropriate for people who have some memory concerns. There's something that takes 10 or 15 minutes to do instead of 3 hours to do. And they're, you know, fairly easy to learn and to administer. And, you know, so for memory function, that's a good baseline.
I mean, given what we know about the value of finding it early and treating early to slow the progression, should some sort of baseline test be included for all of us when we're young and vital?
I guess the question is, at what point do those tests get started being done, and then at what point do you start doing something about it? The donanemab data showed that patients who had a lower amount of tau protein in their brain, and remember I said earlier
right,
that tau accumulates much closer in the time to when people develop symptoms. Folks who had a lower amount of tau in their brain, they divided them up low, medium, and high. Folks with low tau did a lot better with treatment than the folks who had more tau accumulation. So that says, yeah, treating earlier is going to have benefit and might be cost effective. But there have been other studies looking at people who are pre-symptomatic, looking at folks who have a gene that you know, guarantees Alzheimer's disease, and at least within the constraints of how those studies were done, they have not yet shown benefit to early treatment. So if you do show early treatment, then you have to figure out the big question of who's going to pay for it. Because if you're then saying, okay, we have this that slows progression, we're going to treat you for the next, you know,
doesn't that
X
make
many
you sick?
Years.
Doesn't that make you sick, though? I mean, we have to figure out who's going to pay for this. If we show that, okay, we can save X number of people from going off the deep end or getting full-blown dementia.
Yeah, I mean, obviously
the money
comes from somewhere, right? Yeah. It comes from somebody paying for the medication, or it comes from society paying for the care in some way, shape, or form for somebody who didn't get the medicine. Mm. And
another show. We'll have to do that another time.
Absolutely.
Let's go back to the phones, and it looks like Rosendale is the place, Thomas is the person. Thomas, you're on.
Hi, I'm Thomas. I'm from Rosendale, as I mentioned. I'm 59 years old, and I was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease about a year ago, although I kind of for a couple of years before then. Well, it's kind of kicking me from pillar to post, to be honest.
Sorry.
And I was just wondering what the state of treatment and possible cures are for this disease.
Okay.
Well, I think similar to Alzheimer's disease, that there are a number of symptomatic meds, much more than for Alzheimer's. There are medicines that work to replace dopamine in the body. There are medicines that work to stimulate the dopamine receptor without being dopamine. There are a ton of medications that help to alter dopamine metabolism. And so those are symptomatic treatments. There are medicines that are in development to slow progression of Parkinson's. Alpha-synuclein is a protein that builds up in Parkinson's the same way that amyloid and tau build up in Alzheimer's. So similar to what we've been talking about in Alzheimer's treatment, there are monoclonal antibodies being looked at to get at alpha-synuclein. To my knowledge, none of them has yet shown benefit, but that's a big thing. And the next thing we'll be trying to figure out what else can be done, trying to figure out how to identify the problem as it's starting and how to stop it at that point. So there's a lot of work yet to be done.
Thomas, thanks a lot. Appreciate the call to Malta, and it's Sue's turn. Sue, you're on. Only about a minute here,
Sue. Good afternoon.
Okay.
Okay, just a quick question on the two new FDA-approved medications. My husband has been diagnosed with dementia / Alzheimer's. Does he need to see a neurologist to see if he's eligible, or his primary has him on Aricept? Can we go back to our primary and see if he's a candidate for those meds? And are they only IV?
They are only IV. And at this point, I think the only people who should be prescribing them are either neurologists or geriatricians who have a strong dementia focus. There may be some geriatric psychiatrists as well at a couple of centers. But primary care doctors, it's just too complicated for them to stay on top of the procedures and the safety measures, and the safety measures are the biggest part. So,
okay. Sue, thanks a lot. Very quickly, an email here from Karen in Albany. Please speak to the probability or not of developing dementia when it has occurred in multiple generations. My mom's side of the family have it, and my mother has dementia. She's now 87. There's none in my father's extended family, and we have about 20 seconds.
Yeah, so late-onset dementia, dementia after age 65, is considered sporadic, meaning there's no single gene that determines that. If your parent had early onset, then you'd have about a 50% chance of having that gene and getting it. So the risk isn't quite that high. The best thing that people with a strong family history can do is to keep themselves healthy, to make sure their blood pressure is okay, their blood sugar is okay, they're exercising regularly. That's the big one that you can't put into a pill. Keeping their brain stimulated, being part of a community face-to-face, being part of the AMC community, maybe contributing to the lockbox might
yes.
give some benefit. I'm not sure.
Well done, sir.
Worth looking into. But those are things you can do to try and keep your brain healthy.
Dr. David Hart, you brought it home with a flourish there, and thanks for mentioning the lockbox. It's open at WAMC.org. Hey, man, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Give me the over-under. Giants, 6 wins? No?
Let us hope.
All right, man. Support comes from Dr. John Shen, specializing in endoscopic spine surgery and disc regeneration, treating disc herniations, spinal stenosis, and myelopathy. envisionspinesurgery.com for details. Thanks again to Dr. David Hart of Stratton VA Medical Center in Albany for being with us today. Thank you for listening. Many apologies if we didn't get to your call, and there are about 15 emails I haven't gotten to here. You know what? We're going to do this topic again and again because it, alas, does not go away. So we'll do the topic again. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Bob Rathman, who screened the calls. Beautiful job. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, oh, this is exciting. Gordon Fricke is back to help keep your engine purring. We'll see you too.